Education. And we're delighted to welcome you all for the second year in our temporary quarters. And if things go as planned, next year this time we will be back in the Capitol. Our call of the first case, which is 98-1849 Smith versus General Casualty Company. Representing Mr. Smith is Attorney Mishlock. You may proceed, counsel.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Andrew Mishlock and I represent Gary K. Smith, the petitioner, appellant, and plaintiff. And I'd like to start just by thanking you for this opportunity. I've been at bar for almost 20 years now, and it's still a bit of a thrill to walk in and see you all. I do appreciate this very much.
We'll see if you can say that at the end of your...
I was on my way to court this morning on the highway, and as I was driving, a truck in front of me kicked up this big piece of metal. And as it was coming toward me, I tried to identify it. I couldn't quite tell what it was, and immediately, of course, the first thing that came to my mind is this more like Denholler, is this more like Fetz? And realizing that that wasn't really the issue that was ripe for adjudication, I missed it, and here I am to tell the story. I really have only a few brief comments, and I'm not going to use but a small portion of my allotted time. There are four things that I'd like to emphasize, and it'll be very brief. The first one is that the uninsured motorist statute very clearly, in my view, from its plain meaning and its legislative history, as brief as that is, includes chain reaction collisions. If the legislature, when this statute went into effect in 1979, meant to enact a direct contact rule, there was certainly an awful lot of precedent, an awful lot of law available to them. They were certainly aware of the issue, and they didn't use any language which could be construed to imply direct contact. Now, they did adopt a legislative council note which indicated that hard cases would be referred to the courts. And it seems to me that chain reaction collisions really aren't hard cases. Hard cases are cases like Donnell and Theis, not this case.
Is that because the concern about fraudulent claims is not present in this case? You feel that it's, because that seems to be the genesis and the concern behind the requirement of a hit or some contact.
I would say that's one reason why this is not a hard case, but the other reason is simply the overwhelming body of authority that places this category of cases much closer to direct contact cases than missing runs and dropped object cases, which are...
You could have, and I'm not sure in this case, a driver that says, somebody forced me off or somebody ticked my car and therefore that's why I ran into so-and-so. So isn't that prevalent also?
Well, that's the miss and run situation that I think the exception in the insurance contract and the legislation was designed to address. Personally, I don't feel that fraud is really that legitimate a concern. We have an adversary system to test fraudulent claims, and I don't believe actions of victims should be presumed to be criminals simply because they're making a claim,
sure,
which still has to be tested by the court. Nevertheless, the legislature, I think, in the, using the hit-and-run language, and of course Wisconsin precedent supports that, there has to be some kind of impact.
Yeah, I wasn't looking at it in a criminal sense. I was looking from the testimony of the driver, and as I recall, in this case, there was at least a witness who allegedly saw some contact.
In fact, in this case, Mr. Smith, my client, did not see the other car, did not allege it was there. That came from the defendant, Mr. Blaine, and the witness, Mr. Miller.
Counsel, what do I do with this lingering thought? Maybe I just throw it away. I know the testimony of the driver that saw apparently this phantom vehicle in the rearview mirror, but just the physical difficulty. If I'm driving down the road and I have an 18-wheeler next to me, and the physical improbability that my touching or even ramming that 18-wheeler is going to cause that 18-wheeler to be thrust into another lane. That bothers me, but perhaps it's something that I cannot consider and so I should toss away.
Well, I agree with both of those comments. It is an issue of fact, which I don't think is properly before the court, but Mr. Lane testified that the car didn't hit the chassis of his truck, but hit the left front wheel. So it wasn't a question of a small object moving a big object, which would be physically improbable. It was a question of this smaller object hitting the wheel and actually steering the larger object into Mr. Smith's car, which renders it a lot more probable.
That would be a question for the jury, assuming it went against the
fact finder.
If it's improbable, then maybe Blaine is liable, although that's not in this case.
My third point, the second one was the whole issue of fraud. The third point is, I think
any... Before you get to your third point, was there physical evidence? There's testimonial evidence. Was there physical evidence that a car hit the truck's wheel?
It's really unclear. I don't think a terrific investigation was done. Mr. Blaine testified that the left front bumper of his truck was bent in a manner that would support the notion that the impact had occurred and there were some marks on the fender, but that damage had been repaired.
Well, if you look at the statute, it says an unidentified motor vehicle. There was one here.
For the purpose of this argument, that's beyond dispute, that's yes.
Involved in a hit-and-run accident. Right? So there's an unidentified motor vehicle involved. So the question is always boils down to what is a hit-and-run accident? Who has to be hit?
Well, I proposed the rhetorical question. If this wasn't a hit-and-run, what else would we call it? I think to call it anything but a hit-and-run.
Well, there was a hit to Blaine. Let us just assume that for
yes.
a moment. And there was a running from Blaine.
Right.
But not a hit-and-run as far as Smith is concerned.
Well,
because Smith was hit by Blaine, and Blaine didn't run.
I think I refer to the language of the Michigan court in the Lord case when they talked about Newtonian physics and the transfer of force from one object to the other. Certainly the force was transferred from the vehicle that hit and ran into Mr. Smith's vehicle through the mechanism of the steering mechanism of Mr. Blaine's truck.
So this fits into the indirect kind of contact cases.
It is an indirect contact case, yes.
Now the policy is very different. General Casualty's policy says that a hit and run vehicle is one whose owner can't be identified and which hits you or a family member or hits the vehicle. So it seems to me under General Casualty policy.
I'm sorry?
It seems to me that under General Casualty's policy, you don't fit the policy.
Well,
do you concede that?
Every jurist who has considered this issue in this case up to this point agrees that General Casualty's policy excludes this, but obviously the statute controls. I don't agree with that, and I've explained that in the brief. I think the language of the policy goes back to the mid-60s. There's a huge body of case law interpreting that policy language to include indirect contact cases, and I think that's what controls. Also,
you think that will control even if the statute is interpreted narrowly? being...
Well, the statutory language is far broader than the policy language, so I don't see that as being a reasonable occurrence. It seems to me that what the court should do is enforce the reasonable expectations of policyholders who bought and paid for policies. And given the history and the language and the law all over the country, I think it's fair to say the reasonable expectations of every policyholder is that when you're driving down the highway and you're hit through no fault of your own, even in an indirect contact case, you're going to have coverage. To me, it strains credulity to think that you wouldn't have coverage in such a situation. And that's a point that I think is very important.
Do we have to overrule Hain?
No, absolutely not. Hain is a miss-and-run case. Hain could remain good law.
That's a two-car miss-and-run case.
Wagner is a three-car miss-and-run case. I don't remember how many cars, but it's a miss-and-run case. Those three cases are very instructive, but they certainly don't control the outcome in this case. And again, there's a large body of law from other jurisdictions that supports that distinction. And my final point is, this court's already ruled in Theis that what's essentially a dropped object case is covered. And the language that the court used in Theis really leaves the question open of whether Theis is an indirect contact case that controls the outcome here, or whether it's a direct contact case because the leaf spring was a piece of a vehicle, an unidentified vehicle. And I'm not asking the court to resolve that. I don't think that's part of this case in controversy, but I submit that given the holding in Theis, were this court to affirm the lower court's rulings and adopt a direct contact rule, we would have what I think could only be described as a very bizarre and anomalous state of the law in Wisconsin, where a...
Mr. Meshloff, let me interrupt you, if I might, for just a minute. Talking about the Theis case, I'm thinking about some language that comes directly from that case. The court said the Wisconsin cases have interpreted the hit-and-run provision of Wisconsin Statute 632.32.4 to require physical contact between an insured motor vehicle and an unidentified motor vehicle. Now, do we have to withdraw that language from Theis? Do we have to clarify that language? What would we have to do if we ruled your way?
I think that has to be clarified, just as the language in Amidzich, which is similar, I think needs to be clarified, that applies to a two-car accident and not a chain reaction accident.
Well, you just have to get to indirect contact, isn't that it?
I'm sorry?
You have to interpret it to mean direct or indirect contact.
Yes. Well, I wouldn't put it that broad. This case deals only with chain reaction collisions in which there's the sort of immediate transfer of force between multiple vehicles. Certainly there are a lot of indirect contact cases that would be far less clear than this one.
Give me an example.
Well, the example I gave you this morning about the piece of scrap metal in the road of undetermined origin kicked up by a truck. Perhaps a piece of a vehicle, perhaps a piece of scrap metal. I think at some point the court's going to see a case like that.
Well, I use this in that case. If it's a bowling ball, wouldn't it be any difference?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
If it was a bowling ball and it's not an undetermined piece of scrap or vehicle, would it make a difference?
I think the language of Theis would indicate it makes a big difference, but I've proposed in my briefs that that language should perhaps be limited to the holding in Theis, and that the nature of the object should be but one of many factors considered by the court in determining whether there's a substantial physical nexus. If there's nothing else, I am through. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Is it Frakes or Frakes or neither?
Pardon?
How do you pronounce your name?
Frakes.
Ms. Frakes, representing General Casualty.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jacqueline Frakes, and I represent the defendant respondent, General Casualty Company of Wisconsin. The issue before this court is whether Section 632.32, subsection 4, mandates coverage when there is no physical contact between an unidentified vehicle and an insured vehicle. This court and the Court of Appeals have drawn a line by interpreting the hit-and-run provision of Section 632.32 as requiring physical contact between an insured vehicle and an unidentified motor vehicle, as most recently stated by this court in Feist versus Midwest Security Insurance Company. Plaintiff appellant petitioner is asking this court to erase that line. Defendant respondent is asking this court to hold that line and affirm the direct contact rule in Wisconsin. The plaintiff appellant petitioner is asking this court basically to adopt a causal nexus theory, or what I like to call the Sir Isaac Newton theory.
What's that last word? What theory?
Sir Isaac Newton theory, as described by courts from other jurisdictions. This theory has been around since the late 1960s. It was around at the time that this court decided Hain versus Progressive, Northern Insurance Company, and it was the theory was around when the Court of Appeals decided the cases in Wagner versus Heritage Mutual Insurance Company and Dano versus State Farm Mutual Insurance Company. It's not a new theory, it's an old theory. It's been around a long time. Appellant petitioner is asking this court to rely upon cases from other jurisdictions, which, as set forth in our brief at pages 14 through 16, basically deal with statutes that have language dissimilar to Wisconsin statute and with case law interpreting policy language different from that found in General Casualty's policy. For example, a case cited by plaintiff appellant petitioner in his reply brief is MVAI Corp. Versus Eisenberg, which is a 1966 case. And that case dealt with Section 617 of the insurance law code dealing with arbitration of uninsured motorist claims. And in that particular section, it provides that the claimant must establish that an accident arose out of physical contact of the motor vehicle causing bodily injury with the insured or a qualified person. Other cases that the plaintiff appellant petitioner has cited that rely upon or discuss other statutes foreign to Wisconsin statutes are Sparks versus Nationwide Mutual Insurance Company, which involved the construction of North Carolina's uninsured motorist statute. In North Carolina's uninsured motorist statute, it requires that the person insured must have sustained bodily injury. Another case that deals with a statute from another state is Spalding versus State Farm Mutual Insurance Company, which involved the construction of South Carolina's uninsured motorist statute, which provides that the injury or damage was caused by physical contact with the unknown vehicle. These statutes are very different from Wisconsin's statute that deals with hit-and-run vehicles.
Counsel, you're focusing on Wisconsin, on the statute, and the first sentence in your presentation today, which addressed the issue of the case, framed it as a question of statutory interpretation. What relevance, then, does the policy provision and the argument with regard to what the policy says, what relevance is that in this case?
Are you talking about General Casualty's policy or the underlying purposes of the statute?
Thank you for clarifying. I'm talking about General Casualty's policy. The policy says in Part C, uninsured motorist coverage, which is a hit-and-run vehicle whose operator or owner cannot be identified and which hits A, B, C, all requiring family member or your covered auto.
Correct.
What relevance to this case of statutory interpretation
are the provisions of the general casualty policy in Part C that I've read?
Well, the statute, as Your Honor is well aware, requires that each policy provide for uninsured motorist coverage. General casualties policy provides for uninsured motorist coverage, and as most policies do, it defines what is a hit-and-run vehicle under its policy. I strenuously disagree with counsel for the petitioner in with regards to the fact that general casualties policy would provide coverage in this scenario.
What relevance to a case of statutory interpretation is the question of how the policy defines hit and run? What relevance is that?
Well, obviously,
I don't understand.
The policy itself cannot dictate what the statute means. I guess my answer to that question is that general casualty has, as other insurance companies have, defined the policy. The policy language, though, found in general casualties policy, though, was around at the time that the legislature enacted Section 632.32. And as discussed in Hain, the legislature at the time that they enacted Section 632.32 was well aware of the standard policy definition that a hit-and-run vehicle, in order for there to be a hit-and-run, there must be a hit or physical contact between the unidentified vehicle and the insured vehicle. So in that respect, it is very relevant.
The statute trumps any language that may exist in any policy. Is that correct?
That is correct. If this court decides that Section 632.32 mandates coverage in a case where there is indirect contact, then the definition of hit-and-run vehicle in general casualties policy becomes void.
You, in other words, you substitute in the policy the statutory language because it's a mandatory clause.
What happens is that I believe the policy language remains. It's just that the insurance company can no longer take the position that there has to be direct contact between the unidentified vehicle and the insured vehicle, even though its policy defines hit and run as that.
What about the legislative history here that indicates that the Legislative Council did not see fit to define hit and run because it's generally accepted, but that there'll be cases that will raise other issues and it has to be done on a case-by-case basis? You think they were thinking about this case?
I think the legislature, in examining or in coming up with the language found in Section 632.32, was aware of how the policies defined hit-and-run vehicle, that it required physical contact between an unidentified vehicle and an insured vehicle. And I think they wisely stated that the courts in situations should decide it on a case-by-case basis and draw a line. This court and the Court of Appeals have drawn a line. They have, as stated by Your Honor in Feist, have found that there has to be direct contact between an unidentified vehicle and an insured vehicle.
Well, that's right. And the cases do say that there has to be physical contact. And the whole point in Feist is then what does physical contact contact constitute? That was the issue, in effect.
That's correct.
And the court there said, well, what we are interpreting is what is physical contact, and we're going to say that physical contact includes this unidentified object that's taken out of a motor vehicle. And the court then went through all these cases in Feist and said, what do they teach us? And it winds up saying, although the Wisconsin cases have interpreted the hit-and-run provision of the statute to require physical contact between an insured motor vehicle and an unidentified vehicle, and here's the kick of language, they have not interpreted the statute to negate physical contact, in quotes, between the insured's motor vehicle and a part of the unidentified motor vehicle. So it seems to me that putting Vice and your case together, we'd have to say, although the Wisconsin cases have interpreted hit and run to require physical contact, and they have, every single one of them, between an insured and unidentified motor vehicle, they have not interpreted the statute to negate physical contact between the insured's motor vehicle and an unidentified motor vehicle that hits another vehicle that hits the insured. I mean, that's something that we have not decided.
That's correct. That factual scenario has not yet been put forth to this court. However, in FICE, this court emphasized a number of times that it found or held the way it did because it was a piece or a part of an unidentified vehicle that came into contact with the insured vehicle. This court did not take the position that it could have under the causal nexus theory that any piece of garbage laying on the roadway, or if it was a deer that had flown off and if an unidentified vehicle hit a deer and propelled that into the car. Well, the court did not go that far. The court specifically specified.
Or Justice Wilcox bowling alley. And, of course, good appellate practice would be...
It's just the ball, not the alley.
The bowling alley. Listen, if I do it, I do it there. You don't have to in an appellate practice. You should write that fits the facts. Not write broader, because you don't know what the next case is, and the next case is not the bowling ball.
But as I seem to recall, in FICE, this court specifically contrasted the fact situation in FICE with Dano, which was a chunk of ice falling off of a truck, which would be equivalent to the justice's example of a bowling ball. And this court specifically said that in Dano, it left open the window of the fact that, well, if it's an integral part of the unidentified vehicle, such as a tire or some other piece of an unidentified vehicle, then it meets the purposes of the statute and coverage is allowed under the statute. So this court specifically did not say that a situation such as in Dano, where you have a chunk of ice or a bowling ball, is also covered under the statute. This court limited to a piece of an unidentified vehicle and maintained the direct contact rule in that respect.
Now, you could get much closer if you used an example of a stop sign, street sign, hitting something like that. Then that hitting the your insurer, but you know an unidentified vehicle hit that. What about that situation?
Your question is if an unidentified vehicle hit a stop sign and then the stop sign hits an insured vehicle? That is, of course, an indirect contact type of situation. I do not believe that under the existing case law that would be covered.
Doesn't that seem really unfair when under the statute there's an expectation that you should be covered for an uninsured motorist. If the uninsured motorist hits the stop sign or the street sign, and then your insured hits that through no fault of his or her own, there's no coverage.
I believe the expectation or reasonable expectation of coverage is towards what's in the policy, not so much what's in the statute, because the policy itself defines what is a hit-and-run vehicle, and a person who purchases an auto policy has to have a reasonable expectation of what's covered. Under general casualties policy, clearly there's not a reasonable expectation that there's going to be coverage unless there is a hit between the unidentified vehicle and the vehicle.
That's the public policy expressed by the legislature under 63232 is that there should be coverage. And I'm just trying to, these are wild or weird examples, whether it's the bowling ball, bowling alley, or it's the stop sign, street sign example. But this is why we're doing this, is just to say, all right, we know that something hit that. I think this is even more obvious than perhaps the bowling ball would be the street sign, where it's right there, it's in the street, there's tire tracks show that this unidentified vehicle is.
But one of the purposes of the statute is to prevent fraudulent claims. And the example you've given where there's a stop sign, who's to say that the stop sign was not laying in the road and the person simply ran into it? Again, that would be a fraudulent claim. They could claim that an unidentified vehicle hit a stop sign and propelled it in front of their car, when in fact the stop sign had been laying there and they simply drove it.
You're changing the facts. My facts say that there was this unidentified vehicle that hit the stop sign. So we know that...
You got witnesses.
And they got witnesses.
Oh, you got witnesses in that
situation.
Sure. Well, then there was a witness in the Wagner situation as well. And Wagner, a witness, clearly saw that the uninsured motor vehicle swerved into the path of, the unidentified vehicle swerved into the path of the van, which then swerved into the path of the insured vehicle, and there was alleged contact between the van and the insured vehicle. In Wagner, you had a witness as well, and yet if the court is going to say that it's a witness that then mandates coverage, then you have to eliminate the direct contact requirement altogether, because if there's a witness and there's swerving going on, then no physical contact at all would be required, if that's your sole criteria that there's a witness there.
Ms. Briggs?
Yes.
I apologize for the length of this question. I want to give you a little introduction first.
Okay.
And then I'm going to pose some hypothetical. I'm going to change the facts a little bit here. In Theis, we said that there were three legislative purposes. We identified at least three legislative purposes. One was to compensate the victim as if the unidentified uninsured motorist was insured. The second one was to take into account the reasonable expectations of an insured, and the third was to prevent fraudulent claims. Now, if instead of an unidentified first vehicle in this situation, we had an identified driver who was insured, who stopped. So we've got all three drivers at this, and clearly this first one that went into the truck was negligent. First of all, if I'm a driver of the third one, if I'm Mr. Smith, there's no question, is there, that I can sue the driver of the first one and recover.
Correct.
Correct? And also there's no question that, so that takes care of the first legislative policy. Second one is, I certainly would have every reason to expect to be able to, that I could go up against this person. Correct?
Correct.
And thirdly, of course, there's no fraud, because they're all there.
Correct.
So it seems to me that that's the weakness of your case, that the legislative purposes, the three legislative purposes identified, are all taken care of in this situation. Number one, I should be able to recover, because if that person was insured, or Mr. Smith should be able to recover, because if that person was insured, he could recover against him. And number two, I reasonably expect to recover against them. And number three, there's certainly no fraud. I think your case is very weak because of those. Now, if you could come
Certainly.
At me.
The first or primary purpose that you're talking about is, as you stated before, if the unidentified vehicle in this case had been insured, Mr. Smith could go after it. That argument, Your Honor, could be made in every single case that's been discussed by this court regarding Section 632.32. In every situation, such as in Wagner, if the vehicle in the far left-hand lane had been identified, the insured plaintiff in that case could have gone after that car under a theory of negligence. In the Dano case, if the truck had been identified, the person could have gone after the truck driver or his employer under that theory. And as this court in Theis stated, the primary purpose, that of recovery, is not sufficient to allow recovery when an unidentified motor vehicle does not strike the insured motor vehicle, even though an identified motor vehicle may be liable under the same circumstances. So with all due respect, in Theis, you ruled out that in situations where there's not direct contact between the insured vehicle and the unidentified vehicle, the primary purpose is not met. And that's at paragraph 28 of Theis.
And the court had to do that, because otherwise it would have to overrule Hain.
That's correct. It would have to basically overrule every case that's been decided.
That's right. So to stay within that framework, you had to find something it.
Correct.
And that moved into the Springleaf, which was not part of a, which was not the actual vehicle itself. So the basic premise of these cases is, as you stated, that there has to be physical contact, and that's Hain. And if we, when you move from these other cases, the question is, can you find a physical contact that's going to satisfy it? So Springleaf was one. Now we're into, next will be the bowling ball or the stop sign. And then we have in this case another, we have contact in this case. It's just not between those two cars, Smith and the unidentified. And the question is that contact good enough? As long as you keep a physical contact. You think we are going so far afield we ought to overrule Hain?
No, I don't think we should overrule Hain. And I think that the whole purpose of my argument and General Casualty's argument here today is to maintain the direct physical contact rule. Going on to answer, continuing with my answer of your question, the second purpose of the statute is to honor the reasonable coverage expectations of an insured. And again, we're dealing here with the policy language. And General Casualty's policy specifically requires a hit between the unidentified vehicle and the insured vehicle. No reasonable insured could read General Casualty's definition of a hit-and-run vehicle and believe that they had coverage under this fact scenario. And that brings us to the third purpose of the statute, which is to prevent fraudulent claims. And really, I think this is the main, the whole purpose behind subsection 4 and the hit and run situation is to prevent fraudulent claims. And in the case before us, as I explained in our brief, in this case, although we don't have an insured who's claiming that a vehicle, an unidentified vehicle, caused this accident, we have the person, the sole person that would be responsible for the plaintiff's damages, claiming that there was contact. The purpose of the...
What if there were 100 witnesses so that there's absolutely no question that that first vehicle swerved into the truck? So there is no question that this is not a fraudulent claim. Your position would still have to be the same, wouldn't it?
Well, I think then if we're going to go back to making the fact that witnesses are present the standard, then you eliminate any contact rule whatsoever. Because as I stated, you could have 100 witnesses in the Dano case to verify that, yes, this uninsured motor vehicle set off, this unidentified vehicle set off this accident and caused a chain reaction collision. If that's going to be this court standard, that there has to be a witness or two witnesses or three witnesses or five witnesses, how many witnesses do there have to be to prevent fraudulent claims? Are we going to then keep moving that line further and further?
I'm trying to hypothesize a situation in which there's unquestionably a claim, a hit. No fraud whatsoever. It wouldn't your position still have to be that there's no coverage?
For example, in this case, the truck would show some physical damage. Without a corroboration, but a physical contact corroboration.
A physical contact corroboration?
Yeah, I mean, the truck's... front fender is bent and there's very fresh paint, so it's not an old issue.
Well, I think that same analysis would have to apply in other fact situations, such as where you've got a chunk of ice crashing through someone's windshield. In the Daniel case, clearly there was physical evidence that there was damage to the vehicle, and that was physical contact. It was simply physical contact with something other than the unidentified vehicle. If this court takes that position, then they're going to have to overrule Daniel as well. And again, if we get to the witness aspect of the case...
I'm just trying to pin down what your position is. And it seems to me that your position is, regardless of the absence, unquestionable absence of fraud, there can be no recovery unless there is a direct physical contact between the unidentified motorist
an uninsured and the plaintiff?
My position is that if your honors eliminate the direct physical contact rule, then you have basically opened the floodgates for every single type of claim that could be imagined involving a hit-and-run or phantom vehicle. Because then this court, if the court's going to rely on witnesses or verification, then that becomes an issue, and the physical contact rule goes out the window. Then there has to, if there's witnesses, then there doesn't have to be any physical contact. Or if there's physical contact, then what is it physical contact with? And we believe that since this court decided Hain versus Progressive Insurance Company 17 years ago, the legislature is well aware of how this court has drawn the line, has interpreted the meaning of Section 632.32, and yet the legislature has not seen fit to amend the statute in some way to say that direct physical contact is not required.
In Hain, the concern there, the majority, was the question of fraud.
Correct.
And here, at least for purposes of this case, we have to assume there is no fraud. So this is really different from Hain, is it not?
Well, I disagree with that. I don't think you have to necessarily assume that there is no fraud. We are, for the purposes of this case, conceding, or for this appeal, conceding that there was contact, but I don't necessarily think that means that there was, could not be collusion between two truck drivers and creating a fraudulent situation. But
could I ask you questions?
Certainly.
Justice Babich's hypothetical: the unknown car in the left lane becomes a known car, but in his hypothetical, the car was insured. Suppose that car was uninsured. What is the result with respect to general casualty? Do you pay?
If it's an identified insured vehicle, uninsured vehicle, coverage is provided because that's a separate, it's under a separate definition. We are dealing here, though, with the concept of a phantom vehicle, a vehicle that other than in the mind, in this case, of the truck driver does not, and I'm saying the truck driver witness, does not exist, because really, in this case, the truck driver, the striking vehicle, never saw a phantom vehicle. He just said he felt something. So that's the difference between the definitions. Here we're dealing with a hit-and-run situation, a phantom vehicle situation. This in no way affects coverage where there's an identified uninsured vehicle, which fulfills the primary purpose of the statute.
Suppose you come out of this case a winner. What would be your advice to people like Mr. Smith of how they should protect themselves from these phantom collisions, multiple car collisions?
I don't think there's any advice you can give any driver as far as protecting themselves against a phantom vehicle. There's no advice you can give any driver from protecting themselves against a chunk of ice falling off somebody's truck. In this case, though, unlike the other cases, Mr. Smith at least has a identified person who struck his vehicle that he can pursue under the theory of joint and several liability in this state. He has a person from whom he can recover, and that is A&R Freight and St. Paul Fire Insurance Company.
Well, as a result of some of the cases that have been argued in this court, I have certainly increased my underinsured insurance coverage. But I want to know, if you win the case, what I should do with my policy if I were to be in the situation of Mr. Smith.
Again, I don't think there's anything you can do with your policy. What you can do is pursue the party who hit you.
Well, why can't Justice Prosser call General Casualty and say, I want a rider on my policy. I want you to expand the unidentified motor vehicle provision, and I want it broader than the statute, and I'm willing to pay.
because General Casualty is not willing to underwrite a risk of phantom vehicles. The potential for fraudulent claims is just not worth the, frankly, small premium that most people pay under their personal auto coverage. That's a very large risk to underwrite. The language in their policy has been around since 1966, and as I stated before, was around when the legislature enacted Section
632.32. So it's just not marketable, at least with General Casualty.
Correct. And I would also point out, in terms of the petitioner's argument that General Casualty was somehow supposed to have been aware of these other cases from other jurisdictions, General Casualty is a Wisconsin-based corporation. Their policy is issued in Wisconsin. The last time I checked last time I checked case law regarding interpretation of policies, a policy is always interpreted based on the law in the state in which it was issued.
But it writes policies outside the state, doesn't it?
It does write policies outside the state, and those policies are interpreted by those states' case law. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Mishloff, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
The New York experience, I think, is instructive. The legislative council notes in the drafting file for Section 632.32 sub 4 contained a copy of the New York statute, as the dissent in Hain noted. And New York was the leading state that adopted the direct contact rule under their quasi-public motor vehicle automobile insurance corporation. And they were the leading proponent of the direct contact rule. In a case where a hit-and-run car struck a parked car, which then struck a pedestrian. However, in the Eisenberg case, which goes back to 1966, that was a case where the hit-and-run car actually hit a building and the wall collapsed on the victim. So. New York dropped the direct contact rule. All of that was something the legislature was aware of at the time that this statute was drafted, and yet it chose not to include language which I think could be construed to adopt the direct contact rule.
I'm concerned about all the havoc that can be created by saying there isn't a direct contact rule. That is the third purpose of the fraud. I'm concerned about that. I mean, in this case, who knows what happened? There is room for collusion. And in any case, you're talking about the bowling ball. A single driver driving gets in an accident. Isn't it easy to say, oh, there's an unidentified vehicle that hit the bowling ball that hit me, or hit the stop sign that hit me? Now, I know that's not a component part of the car, but, isn't there all sorts of potential for fraud if you don't have the direct contact requirement?
I have two answers to that. The first answer is the majority of states do not have a physical contact requirement that have considered the issue. They simply have abolished any type of requirement. And I don't think there's any showing that fraud is a huge problem in those states as a practical matter. My second answer is, I think in Wisconsin, given our geography, there probably is a greater chance. For example, there was a case where a motorcyclist said a car knocked a deer into his path. So I'd agree it's a concern, but that's why we have an adversary system. And I don't see that every victim should be precluded from making a claim, which then has to be tested by the adversary system on the chance that some victims will make fraudulent claims.
Well, if it's a one of one, guess what you're arguing has some merit. I just wonder the ability to attack a single car accident that was involved in a hit and run when there's only one person testifying, or in this fact situation, the ability to really impeach testimony of the semi-driver and the driver in front when there are only two witnesses and they're both saying the same thing. I mean, the ability seems to be...
It's certainly not a flawless system, but it still means that the claimant has to perhaps take the witness stand, look the 12 good and true jurors in the eye, and testify in a manner that rings true. I don't think that's a very easy burden. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Schlumpf. Thank you, Ms. Freaks. And that concludes our hearing on Smith versus General Casualty. The court will take a few moments of recess and then come back for our second case.